Good morning, Lord. Good morning, Lord. Today is a special day worth living.
Bishop Haralambos is a Greek Orthodox bishop whose ordination name translates from the Greek to be Happy Light. Bishop Hara, or Happy, will welcome us each morning with an uplifting message of exhortation, bringing us together for wisdom, knowledge, Bible prophecy, and current events, reviewing past prophecies aired on the radio years ago in a Nostradamus fashion. The program will contain miracles, newspaper quotes, and Holy Scripture readings relating to the end times.
Come receive the light in God's Kapheneon. This is Bishop Haralambos. From now on, you can just call me Bishop Hara, and our program will be coming to you each Sunday morning, 8:30 to 9, especially to you live-ins and all you God-blessed people, the beloved of the Lord.
Well, many of you read Parade magazine. Jack Anderson is the Washington editor of that. He's heard daily on network radio over mutual broadcasting system. You see him 5 days a week on Good Morning America, ABC. It's a real privilege to bring on a man who has had a tremendous influence in the United States of America. Ladies and gentlemen, a man that you've heard and read, and a great privilege to have him here sharing on this program with Chuck Colson, Palm Beach Roundtable, Jack Anderson.
I listened to that with grateful embarrassment. It's nice to speak in front of microphones. I could tell what impressed you the most. We've had children by every known form of birth control. I think if a burglar were to break into our home late at night, I think my wife would probably get up sleepily, take him by the hand, and lead him to the bathroom. I probably, since this is somewhat of an ecclesiastical occasion, I probably should begin with a confession. I think I will. I think that I'll tell you a true story, and I will use the language, of course, because I'm a reporter, and I'll have to give it to you authentically, exactly as it occurred. And it occurred just a couple of weeks ago. I happened to have been in Dallas, Texas, and as I left, I was joined by a Texas oil man, complete with a 10-gallon hat. He sat alongside of me. I wanted to sleep. He wanted to talk. He won. Finally, he introduced himself and wanted to know my name. I told him it was Anderson. He said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Washington." He said, "Washington State?" "No, Washington, D.C. "With the government?" "No." "What do you do?" "Newspaper work," I said. "With the Washington Post?" "No." "Which paper are you with?" "Well, I write a column and it appears in several papers." He got more interested. "Anderson, what's your first name?" "Jack," I said. There was a glimmer of recognition. He turned to me and said, "Oh," he said, "you're the horse's ass." " I told him there were people in the Nixon and Carter administrations who shared his opinion. I have observed both from afar and from close up the conversion of Chuck Colson. But I thought, since we are talking about born-again people here, I'll let him tell his story, and I will talk about one who's not here, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter came to Washington some 2 years ago with a great clanking of the Crusader's armor. He has proclaimed his religious convictions. He has identified himself as a born-again Christian. Well, now it's my job to be skeptical. I've sent reporters to the state of Georgia. They spent some 3 months down there talking to the people who knew Jimmy Carter the best, talking to people who were close to the president, so that we might find out a little bit more about him, so that we might form our own judgments. I've talked to people who are Washington professionals who have gotten to know him in the past 2 years. And I've visited him in the Oval Office. He was candid, I felt. Courteous. I asked impertinent questions. I asked prying questions. Probably should have thrown me out. And I think at this point he would. But at that point he responded, I thought, quite truthfully. At least I felt he was being truthful. And I reached these conclusions. And they may not be accurate. This was my own judgment. That Jimmy Carter is basically a decent human being. That he is indeed a man of deep conviction. He told me that he prays about matters of government, and that indeed he delivers prayers at least a dozen times a day in the Oval Office. Now, this is something that I would have to recommend to anyone who inhabits the Oval Office. But other presidents have also prayed. Even Lyndon Johnson prayed in the Oval Office. I remember, I didn't like him too well, but I remember visiting him once right after he had ordered the bombing of North Vietnam. It was a memorable occasion, and I think my memory of it is clear. I recall that it was about dusk. I remember the Oval Office door shutting behind me. I found myself alone with the president. He was an imposing figure. He was a big fellow to begin with. And you put the prestige of the presidency on top of that, and he was overwhelming. But on this occasion, it was his custom, when you entered the Oval Office, for him to embrace you. He would hug you to his bosom. He would suffocate you in his embrace. And he would get about 2 inches from your ear. And he would fill you with the latest LBJ lore. On this occasion, he was different. He sort of beckoned feebly for me to join him, and he was standing alongside the full-length French windows, French doors, looking out into the, from the Oval Office into the Rose Garden. And I stood alongside him, and he was talking softly. Had the impression he was talking more to himself than to me, and it went something like this, and I remember it quite well, so this is pretty close. He says, you know, the worst part of this job is sending young men at the prime of their lives on missions, knowing some of them aren't going to come home. He says, they take off for North Vietnam at 1 a.m. our time. He says, now, Lady Bird and the doctor, they won't let me stay up after 1. And they won't let me keep an alarm clock by my bed. But he says, I don't need an alarm clock. He says, it takes those boys 2 hours to complete their mission. At 3 a.m, I'm awake. He said, I reach over and I grab the telephone by my bedside. And I ask for the situation room. And I say, how are my boys? He says, if many of them are missing, I don't sleep too well. Now, he said, I believe that their deaths are going to save lives. That their sacrifices may even ultimately save millions of lives. He says, that's the way I got it figured. He says, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. He said, I pray about it. But it's hard to know what God wants you to do. Most of our presidents, I feel, have prayed, and most of them have had trouble figuring out what God wanted them to do. I think Jimmy Carter knows what God wants him to do. I have talked to him. He has great faith in the source of his inspiration. That faith, I think, comes from the purity of his heart. He comes to Washington with a pure heart. He comes to Washington wanting the best for us. He wants what's good for America. He wants peace in the world. He wants prosperity. He wants all the oil that you can use. He wants everything that is best for us. So he knows that his heart is right. It's how he goes about getting it that bothers me. He comes to us without experience. From the peanut fields of Georgia. There is nothing that he did during his one term as governor of Georgia that qualifies him to be president of the United States. He wants to be a good president. He is a bright man. He gets up at 5 in the morning usually, 5:30, no later. Usually, he's in the Oval Office by 6 o'clock. He goes through stacks of presidential paper. He's a speed reader. He is taking a cram course on how to be president. He is working hard at the job. He is trying to do well. The majority of Americans elected him because they were tired of the old politicians and the old politics, and they had good reason to be. And so they wanted a breath of fresh air in the Oval Office. And so they elected this peanut farmer from Georgia. I don't mean that a person from the people, that a politician from the hinterlands cannot be a good president. I think he could bring the mood to the people, that he could understand what the people wanted, and that he could translate that into policy. But there's only one way he can succeed at that. And that's to surround himself with professionals who know what they're doing. Oh, now Jimmy Carter did pick a competent cabinet. You might remember that he went to great trouble. He was painstaking in choosing cabinet officers who were qualified. He checked their qualifications. He tried to choose them on the basis of merit. And the result is that he has surrounded himself with a competent cabinet. Cyrus Vance is quite capable of conducting our foreign affairs. Harold Brown spent most of his adult life both in and out of the Pentagon, but connected with the Defense Department. There are few people who understand it better. Cyrus Vance would make a very fine Secretary of State, as Harold Brown would make a good Secretary of Defense. Unfortunately, Jimmy Carter is our Secretary of State. He is our Secretary of Defense. He is our Undersecretary of State. He is our Undersecretary of Defense. He is our Assistant Secretary of State. And there are people in the State Department who have assured me that on occasions he is a State Department desk officer. They have actually seen working papers that desk officers normally prepare in Jimmy Carter's handwriting. He makes the big decisions. He makes the small decisions. In the Middle East, he conducted most of the negotiations. Did so with big sheets of yellow paper, taking copious notes. At one point, he attacks each problem, the Middle East, whatever else. He attacks each problem pretty much as he did each course when he was attending Annapolis. By boning up on it, by focusing on one course, by concentrating on it, by taking a cram course, then going out and passing the test. And then taking another course and focusing on that. He takes our problem somewhat similarly and becomes an expert in the trivia of that problem. He does not talk to many people. He reads their reports instead. He consults with very few. I once asked him who his advisors were. I said, Mr. President, who is it that you take your advice from? He said, well, because he's extremely candid. He says that the person that I listen to most of all, the one who influences me the most, is Rosemary, Rosalind. I thought I knew her name. Well, there's one, you see, Rosalind comes from Georgia, too. And arrived in Washington at the same time he did. She really doesn't know much more about it than he does. Well, I thought, Mr. President, you know, I was sure that I felt that I knew what he meant. And I said, well, I also listen to my wife because she's got better judgment than I do. And she keeps my feet on the ground and I know what you're saying, Mr. President, but I'm talking about Washington problems. Who is it that you turn to? Well, he said, next to Rosalind, the person that I listen to the most and from whom I take advice from the most is Charles Curbo. He's an Atlanta attorney. Now, if you have a problem in Atlanta, he would be a good fellow to talk to. But his wife won't even let him come to Washington except for one day at a time. They call him Overnight Curbo. His wife says he's got to get back. That isn't long enough, really, to be able to solve our problems. Well, I said, Mr. President, I wanted to help him. I said, I mean, the people here in Washington, who is it that you listen to? He then named them, and I will give you every name that he gave to me. Hamilton Jordan, Joni Powell, Stu Eisenstadt, and Robert Lipschutz. They all come from Georgia. They all arrived the same time he did. Now, no reflection on Georgia, because there are in Washington people from Georgia who are quite competent. They've been there a long time. They know what they're doing. There are people from Georgia who are very good. Jimmy Carter is not one of them. But my friends, he is so convinced because of his born-again status, that he is on the right wavelength. And I say this as a religious man myself. He believes that the inspiration is coming through. Now, if you're getting advice from that quarter, you don't have to pay any attention to Cyrus Vance. And let me tell you what's happening. What's going on right now? A couple of weeks ago, There were two events that occurred, and one of them you watched on television. One of them was quite celebrated. Almost every reporter in America seemed to be covering this event. We were all watching it. TV cameras focused on it. That was the signing of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. If this brings peace to the Middle East, it'll be a great event. Jimmy Carter believes in it. He wants peace. He tried hard. But he was dealing with this one problem at a time. He was focusing on this one. There was another event that occurred the same week. It occurred in Geneva. The Arab oil ministers met there at the OPEC meeting. And they met there as a direct result of the signing of the peace treaty. And they responded and reacted to the peace treaty. I tell you this because I have seen the confidential reports on their closed door meetings. It won't surprise Chuck that I have access to them. And I can tell you what happened. They were angry over the signing of the peace treaty. They felt that the United States had betrayed the other Arab countries. And they were determined to teach us a lesson as they had in 1973. In 1973, they quadrupled the price of oil. And they did that as a direct result of American intervention in the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. At this meeting, they spoke of oil as a weapon. They intend and are using it as a weapon. They're waging economic warfare against the United States. There's no other way to describe it. Economic warfare against the United States. They took time out to watch the treaty signing. They were staying at Geneva's Intercontinental Hotel. And the hotel dragged in, hauled in TV sets for them to watch the signing. They went back in an ugly mood. They were afraid to raise the world price. Some wanted to raise it 50% and some 20%, but they were afraid to do that. They were afraid that would be too harsh, that there would be immediate repercussions and possibly even retaliation. So they decided to hold the world price down to 9%. But they left a loophole. They decided that each Arab country could charge premium prices. Now, the only way you can get a premium price for oil is to create a shortage.
And I looked and I saw a white cloud in the sky, which sat one like the Son of Man, on his head a golden crown that shined. He had a sickle in his hand, which was glistening and sharp. It pointed down towards the land. The earth was now damned. Out of the temple a voice came, crying loudly to proclaim, the time has come, thrust in your sickle and reap, for the harvest is ripe. So use your power, you've the right. Don't curb your appetite. Go sickle it, please. I'm on bended knees. You sat upon the cloud, put his sickle into the ground. He sickled all around, an angel did see. Then from the altar an angel came. He said, the ones that are to blame, they have the devil's name. They walk around earth, causing pain, misery, and hurt. The angel had called the fire, complete and do not tire. Our God is not a liar. To the angel he said, thrust in your sickle there, there's nothing else to spare. Mankind, they did not care. Gather the vine, our grapes are ripe and they're all mine.
It's important that I tell you St. Michael Academy of Eschatology is sponsoring this program. It is a Bible seminary, an Orthodox Bible Seminary, and it's under the State of Florida Board of Education and of Colleges. Profoundly, it's right in our midst for you to learn. Please, you can write St. Michael Academy to enter into anywhere from the associate program to the doctorate program. All approved by the State of Florida in its curriculum. 7007, Post Office Box 7007, West Palm Beach, Florida, 33405. I also want to have a feedback from my beautiful listeners. You can reach me, your Bishop Harold Ambos, or Bishop Harry, or Bishop Happy, at msn.com, Archangel Michael, low caps, Archangel Michael, A-R-C-H-A-N-G-E-L, one word, at msn.com. I'm waiting to hear from you for any subject matter in theology or philosophy that we can speak about on this program. It's important I let you also know that my qualifications are a PhD in both theology and philosophy. God bless you.